spiel, which I've already mentioned in email, but again, so this is not obviously our in-depth interview. What mm-hmm. we're doing here is a trailer, basically a movie trailer. So we need super general, dumbed down, you know, stuff. And I'll remind you of that. People have a tendency to want to explain and go into detail, and we just can't use that in this particular case.
Got it.
And so broadly speaking, what I'd like to do is walk you through a bit about the development of MCAS, you know, just kind of your critique of it, what it might reveal about the culture inside Boeing, as far as we can tell by you know, being on the outside, but observing what this thing is. The two crashes and anything that you're not comfortable with, we'll just skip.
Okay.
The two crashes, your response to them, Boeing's response to them, the FAA, and then some big questions at the end. Essentially it. Probably about 45 minutes, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Great. Charlotte, have you met Charlotte? Charlotte is a producer on the film.
We've exchanged emails, so yeah, hi. Okay. Good, glad to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Are we good, Charlotte and Nicola, in terms of our end?
We are all set, yeah.
Okay, all right. In that case, I'm just going to launch in. One other thing, Greg, do not be afraid to repeat yourself.
Okay.
But if you do repeat yourself, try not to say, as I said before, or, you know, again, or anything like that.
Yeah, okay.
But don't worry about repeating yourself, okay?
All right.
So let's go back to the first crash, Lion Air, back in October 2018. Do you remember hearing about that? I know you're an avid follower of aviation stuff. Do you remember what you thought, what you were thinking at the time?
I certainly remember hearing about it. You know, anytime there's any kind of something in the news about airplanes, it's going to pique my interest. And I gathered a few details at the time, and it kind of went into my thinking of, well, this is, you know, it's an airplane crash. We'll see what happens. We'll see what it's all about. It wasn't until fairly shortly after that, however, that rumors, if you will, started to emerge that there was only a single, that there was a system in place to push the nose down. It relied on only a single angle of attack sensor. I remember hearing that. And I was incredulous in the sense that I immediately thought, no, that there's some detail here that's not right. Because you just never do that in aviation. You never rely on a single sensor, particularly a single sensor that has the authority to do anything to the airplane's attitude. There's always redundancy. So when I heard that there wasn't redundancy, immediately my mind said, you're missing something. You know, so let's sit back and I'm sure that more details will emerge that will make this, you know, more clear.
And what happened?
Well, you know, it kind of persisted, and it was in the back of my mind. I wasn't thinking much about it. Fast forward kind of to March of last year, and my son and I were getting ready to fly our plane to Montreal for spring break. And I think it was the day before we were scheduled to leave, the Ethiopian crash happened. And it was, as I recall, it was really pretty rapidly after that it came out that the same basic causal chain of events seemed to have happened. And I think at that time I had gotten more reinforcement that there was only a single sensor in the Lion Air crash. But I still was so, it was so hard to believe that I continued to have kind of this, I must be missing something, if that makes sense. And then the Ethiopian crash happened, and it was like, no, this strongly reinforces that. And I remembered, I was just floored. Again, it's such an aberrant, it's such a out of the envelope kind of thing that you're just, you know, somebody who's got experience, you know, a certain amount of experience with the industry, knows how things are done, you just can't believe it. I mean, it's literally the definition of unbelievable. I continued to kind of search for, no, there must be something else here. And then while we were on vacation in Montreal, I had some time in the hotel room and I did a lot more research, and I had kind of an epiphany, and I thought, oh my God, this is actually what happened. And then I started to kind of search in my head, you know, how could this have happened? Right? How could it have happened? And my initial thought was to focus on the software. I'm a software engineer, a lot of experience there. And I thought there must have been some kind of disconnect where the people who developed the software simply didn't have the aviation domain knowledge, if you will, to understand that writing software that did things to accomplish this task in this way wasn't right. And
that
surprise you at
a company like Boeing?
Yeah, again, I mean, one area of disbelief fed into another, which was, okay, that implies some kind of a management breakdown, right? The people it's fine if you have junior programmers, maybe they don't have any aeronautical experience, but there have to be supervisors, you know, who are looking over the specifications, looking over the requirements and saying, hey, no, you can't do it that way. You know, let's do it this way instead because it'll frankly be safer. And apparently that hadn't happened. Again, you're looking at the evidence and you're thinking, well, but we have this crash, so that didn't happen. How could that not have happened? And that was a huge question for me for a long time.
Greg?
Yeah.
Let me stop you there because we got a little frozen screen.
Okay.
I really want to get this clean. It's great. You started to say how. Did you just finish that sentence?
Yeah, sure. I'll try and remember where I was. Again, I was thinking to myself, how could this have happened? It's fine if you have, people who don't have experience who are writing the software, so long as there's sufficient supervisory and mentorship and that kind of stuff that can kind of guide them along to the right way of doing things. But we've got this evidence in the form of not one, but now two crashes that says that didn't happen. And then you start to think, well, in a company like Boeing, how is that possible? You know, how did the process that must have been in place, how did that process break down? I kind of chewed on that. It was one of those things where it's just unbelievable. And so you are naturally kind of filled with self-doubt. You think there's something I'm missing, right? We've got these sets of evidence, which are very clear, but it doesn't make any sense. I mean, you literally become disconnected in a sense because what you're seeing is so at odds with what you would expect to be seeing. It's completely foreign. And so I kind of went on and I thought, well, it must just be that there's been some kind of breakdown. And how could that breakdown have happened? And that's kind of where I switched from looking at this as a typical airplane accident where you look from the bottom up, you know, you put together, you say, oh, okay, this part failed because of a manufacturing problem or whatever. These are all process kinds of things. You're looking, you know, typical aviation accident inspection is a bottom up thing. And I said, no, this is the pieces on the ground aren't the clues that we need to understand this. We have to switch focus, and you've got to look at it forensically, not from the bottom up, but from the top down. You know, how did the process go awry? Right? It's not a problem with the process itself. It's not like a machine failed and made a bad part. Something systemic occurred. And for a systemic event, you have to look not from the bottom up, but from the top down.
Fantastic. Uh-huh. I'm wondering if your experience as a pilot informed your incredulity, your desire to understand. You're not just anybody, you're not just a software engineer, you're a pilot. And I think pilots, of all the people I've talked to, are the most pissed off, bewildered. I'm just throwing that out there.
Yeah.
The fact that you're a pilot fueled this for you.
Oh, absolutely.
Give me a full sentence, Greg.
Yeah. As a pilot, you are taught, and in fact, you are legally responsible for the safe completion of every flight. That all of that liability, there's a concept called, codified in the regulations, pilot in command. That is a legal responsibility. And part of your ability to fulfill that legal responsibility is your ability to control the airplane. And we had a situation here where that ability was removed from the pilots. So I'll give you some kind of technical examples. Every airplane that I've ever flown, and I think that most pilots are familiar with, if you pull hard enough on the column, you know, if the airplane is trying to go down and you pull back, the airplane gets out of the way. It disconnects. It senses that. And in fact, in the 737, there's something called the column cutout switches, which are designed to do exactly that. If the pilot is pulling up really hard, the airplane says, okay, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm going to give the authority back to her, if you will. And again, it came apparent that MCAS didn't do that. So here you have you have the taking of the pilot's ultimate authority away from them, yet the liability still accrues to them. Does that make sense? And that's fundamentally unfair from a pilot's point of view.
You froze.
Yeah, I saw you freeze too.
Right after, did that make sense?
Okay.
Can you just pick up that last bit?
Yeah, so.
It does make sense, by the way.
Okay, so again, the law says the pilot's responsible. We've always understood that from a pilot's perspective to mean that ultimately we will be able to fulfill our responsibility by having control. MCAS was the first system that I know of in which that control was taken away from the pilots, but the pilots were not, the responsibility was not taken away from them as well, right? And from a pilot's point of view, that's monstrously unfair.
In fact, blame was accrued.
Yes, I was going to get into that. Okay, yeah.
I'm going to come back to this whole issue with the pilots later, but let me ask you this question. You started to talk about accident investigations and how they're usually done from the bottom up and so on. In a way, an accident is a story, right?
Absolutely.
An accident is a story. Is it fair to say that you wanted to understand this story? And if that... I know that's sort of simplistic, but in a way, that's what this was, wasn't it? I mean, for you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm very interested in aviation accidents. Ever since even before I became a pilot, that was 30 years ago, as an engineer and somebody's interested in technology, I'm always interested in knowing, you know, what went wrong and how did it go wrong. So I'm very, I think, familiar with a lot of standard airplane accidents. And you're right, they all tell a story. I'm thinking in my mind right now about, you know, the various DC-10 accidents that happened early in that aircraft's lifestyle or lifespan. And they all told a story. They were overwhelmingly technical and engineering stories. You know, again, a part failed. Why did it fail? Well, let's look at that story. Let's look at the chain of things, right? Maybe there was a certification problem, et cetera. But they're all, you know, I don't know if this is the right word for it, but it's kind of transactional, right? It's not epic. The character of the MCAS story is one of an epic to me, as opposed to, you know, kind of a transactional story.
What do you mean? What makes it epic?
Well, it's tragic in the sense that long before either one of the two crashes happened, the conditions that made them inevitable were set in motion. That's not necessarily true in my mind about other types of crashes. You know, they can be, again, if you have a part failure, maybe it was because the machine on the day that the part made had a flaw in it, right? That doesn't tell you, it's not a huge chain of events that are going on for months and years that lead up to it. It's just an isolated incident. So this was much bigger in that it became inevitable years before it actually happened.
Classic tragedy.
Yeah, yeah. So that's how I think of it. That's how I describe it.
All right. Let's unpack that chain of events, that story, and you can start way long ago, but let's start for the time being with the first, maybe the original sin, which was the decision to retrofit a 737 rather than build a clean, cheap plane.
Uh-huh.
So to begin with, and I know that we'll get into some of the reasons, you know, even deeper, but well, let me ask this. Why did Boeing make that decision? Bottom line, why did they make that decision?
Well, there's always, in aviation, there's always a, do we start with a clean sheet design or do we milk what we've got? You know, an airliner has a lifespan of 30, 40, 50 years. And, it makes a lot of sense to just, you know, if you're facing competition and you need to meet that competition, do we meet that competition with what we already have, you know, improved or tweaked to meet that competition, or do we start all over and come up with a clean sheet? And that's a constant kind of deliberation that goes on in the industry, and there's nothing wrong with it, frankly. But somebody at some point has to make a decision about, we've taken this thing as far as it can go. And we need to start over because, you know, as an airliner, this is true for most things, as an airliner evolves over time, not only is it improved, but it also starts amassing accumulated debt, if you will. And the original accumulated debt for the 737 was the fact that it sat so low to the ground. Right, that was a decision made back in the 60s when they thought this thing was going to primarily serve unimproved airports with, you know, few ground facilities for loading and unloading passengers and baggage. So they said, let's make it sit real low to the ground so it's easy to get in and out of. That requirement never really materialized. You know, it wasn't a selling point, let's put it that way. Nevertheless, it has constrained the 737 ever since. And the primary way in which it has constrained it that's germane to our discussion is it's constrained the size of the engines that you can fit beneath the wings, full stop. So again, you know, Boeing came up, the direct competitor to the 737 is the Airbus A320. The Airbus A320 is a much newer design, even though it's very old at this point, but it's still a much newer design. Incrementally, Boeing and Airbus go back and forth. They're constantly trying to sell these two airplanes to their customers. Airbus came out with a newer version that had newer engines, more efficient engines. And Boeing, as it always has, said, well, okay, we've got to counter that by essentially putting the same engines so that there's no longer a fuel advantage. Yes.
Let me pause you there. Uh-huh. I want to ask you to put yourself in the minds of the Boeing executives. Here's Airbus decides to release what they call the 320 Neo, right?
Mm-hmm.
New engines.
Yep.
How big a threat is this in the minds of Boeing management? Take me, like, what is going through their heads?
Well, I imagine, I'm not a mind reader, but the profit margins throughout the entire transportation industry, throughout especially aviation, are really razor thin. And, you know, the ability to, I can't remember the number I calculated some time ago, but, you know, if you're going to save $1 million per airplane per year in fuel costs, that starts to add up pretty quickly if you've got 600 of those aircraft in your fleet, you know, as you can imagine. So these things are these decisions are really made right on the margin. And not only that, but there's a lot of horse trading that goes on. So just the fact that Airbus was able to say, we're putting this new engine on here. Now every Boeing salesman has to go up and in their negotiations, you know, with an airline, the airline's going to say, well, Airbus has got this better airplane. We're really thinking hard about looking at that, right? So even if they're not serious, they're going to say that. So you've got to have an answer. It doesn't matter, you know, really how different the new competitor's airplane is. You got to have an answer to why yours isn't just as good. Again, this is a commodity business. And so if you're selling coffee beans and the other guy's selling the same coffee beans, but his are just a little bit better for the same price, You got to have an explanation as to why. Now, what they don't want to do is have that explanation. They want to say, no, ours is just the exact same.
So Boeing was facing a real dilemma here. They were facing, I don't know if it was an existential threat, but it was a deeply alarming threat to a major part of their business. And you know, some people have told me that the right decision at that point would have been to take your lumps and make a new plane.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that Boeing, and again, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, I'm just asking, do you think that Boeing executives panicked in this case?
I don't think they panicked at that point. Again, this is something that they would have been used to, and they would have, I imagine their thinking was, okay, Airbus has got this new thing with a new engine. I remember at the time they put out a lot of press releases essentially poo-pooing it, but they obviously... You know, and also saying there was a Boeing executive who said, you know, they're going to have a lot of trouble putting those engines on that airplane. You know, how ironic. Airbus actually, it's pretty easy for them to do that. But nonetheless, Boeing felt that it had to respond. It had to have something. And Boeing at this point, it's a mature industry, made the decision to take the 737, you know, one more increment.
Mm-hmm. For a child, what is the problem they discover when they try to put these new engines on this old chassis, as it were? And just give me a pause a second because I think you're frozen. There we go. So again, what is the unexpected problem they discover?
So if you could just ask the question again because you paused a little bit,
Again, so a child can understand, what is the unexpected aerodynamic problem they discover from the placement of the engines, new engines on the old chassis, basically?
My understanding is what happened, and this had happened when they put the CFM engines on back in the 80s, is that because of the placement of the engines further forward and a little bit up, the airplane became a little... let's just say, as a child would say, a little more squirrely, like this. You know, instead of being stable, you know, if you touch the control column, it wanted to kind of oscillate here. I think the best term is squirrely.
But what about the pitch up problem?
Well, that's what I mean by the pitch up. So it had a tendency, so here it's flying along, and this is a pitch up. Now, normally an airplane should kind of resist pitching up. As a pilot, you have to keep pulling back on the control column to make it pitch up. And if you relax it, it goes back to normal. It seeks kind of a stable situation. My understanding is that with the new engines, it didn't do that or didn't do that as much as it perhaps should. So if it started to pitch up, worst case scenario, it kept pitching up.
Great. And again, in simple terms, what was MCAS?
MCAS was a system, is a system, frankly, that is designed to sense that pitch up and automatically push the nose down.
It's a software.
It's a software system implemented in the autopilot.
As a software engineer, as a student, as a pilot yourself, how would you characterize the engineering that went into MCAS?
I think I've characterized it in fairly uncharitable terms in print. There's nothing that I have seen that tells me that it is anything other than dirt simple and brutal.
Dirt simple and brutal. What do you mean?
It's simple in the sense that it takes as its input really just the one angle of attack sensor. And it's brutal in that depending on that input, it aggressively tries to counter that pitch up.
They created a monster.
Yeah. Yeah. And the amazing thing is how nobody could have looked at it and said, oh my God, this thing is going to kill people, and it's going to kill people very quickly. And apparently there were some people who said that, and they were overruled.
Let's. What are the two or three features of MCAS that you find most troubling from an engineering standpoint?
From an engineering standpoint, obviously the first one is that it didn't use more than one sensor. It didn't verify. The angle of attack sensors are, they look like wind vanes. They sit on the outside of the airplane. They're relatively fragile, and they're also subject to all kinds of mechanical damages, whether it's the boarding tube running into them, or somebody with a de-icing truck running into them, a bird strike, anything. They're fragile, and they are in a kind of a hazardous physical environment. So there's a large possibility that they can get damaged, which is fine. There's no problem with that. I mean, we deal with that kind of stuff in aviation all the time. But you deal with it typically with redundancy. And that means, in this case, not only having just one angle of attack indicator or two, but three. Because that way, with three at least, you can resolve which one is sorry, that's my clock. With three, you can resolve, you can figure out, hopefully, okay, this one's wrong, I'm going to ignore it. With two, you're not really sure.
The
two outvote the one, exactly. With two, at least you can say, okay, I don't know what anyone's telling me, so I'm going to ignore both of them. With one, you can't do either one of those. Am I pausing here? I don't know if it froze up.
You were, but we're getting your audio clean. We're
okay.
Your audio clean, so I'm inclined not to stop you unless it's a really, really important moment.
So okay. Okay, so with one, you can't do that. Now, there's a couple things you still can do even if you've only got one. And this kind of goes to my second problem with it, was that there was nothing in the software that did any kind of sanity checking on the data that was coming from those angle of attack vanes. And this is standard, again, this is standard software engineering practice, not only in the aviation industry, but really in any industry. If you've got a computer and you've got a software program and it's connected to sensors, physical sensors, well, the first thing you want to do is say, is what the sensor is telling me, does it even make sense? Right? So if you've got something that, for instance, is measuring the temperature of your oven to control the cooking of your turkey for Thanksgiving, and the software is reading the sensor and it says, well, the oven's about 4,000 degrees, right? You wouldn't make a decision that, you know, the oven is actually 4,000 degrees. You would say, in the software, you would say, that's really outside the realm of possibility. So I'm going to ignore it. In the 737 case, you had in the Ethiopian crash, you had a situation where the sensor said the plane went from this to this in 1 second. That's not physically possible. Right. If that had actually happened, the aircraft would have broken up. Yet the software said, oh, that's actually what must have happened, and immediately tried slamming the nose down to counter it. Again, so the fact that the software lacked even just basic sanity checks on its inputs indicates to me that it's extremely low quality. So that was kind of problem number two. Relied on the original sin, if you will, was relying on one sensor, right? And perhaps even a greater sin was not only relying on that one sensor, but believing it no matter what. In fact, neither one of those two crashes would have happened if they had just had basic sanity checks on those. For instance, in the Lion Air crash, typically the sensors droop on the ground. There's no air flowing over them to push them up. So they kind of droop. In the Lion Air crash, the sensor that was stuck, that was broken, wasn't drooping. It was kind of stuck in an up position. The software should have said, "Oh, there are switches that are telling us that we're on the ground, yet the sensor is behaving as if we're flying. I better tell somebody, a pilot, that I've got, for instance, a mismatch in what I expect to see here." But the software didn't even have that test in it. And again, so I mean, people focus on the lack of more than one angle of attack sensor, but if the software had just even those basic tests, which a mildly competent software engineer could code in perhaps 2 days, neither one of those crashes would be happening. We wouldn't be having this conversation right now.
So that's two issues. The third issue I want to talk about is the power. You alluded to this. That they gave this system. And particularly, or authority, or whatever you want to call it, and the re-triggering mechanism, but particularly vis-a-vis the power of the pilot to stop it, right? Talk about that for a second.
Well, again, there are two components to that. One is the fact that the normal override mechanisms, like the column cutout, were overridden in the MCAS case. That's a big problem. It's perhaps a much bigger problem because the pilots were not even told to expect that. So if you're a pilot, I mean, there are situations as a pilot where too much starts happening at once. And when too much starts happening at once, our minds basically shut down. They become unable to look at the bigger picture. And so, and you can get into a situation of panic. And these are all triggered by events happening contrary to what you expect. So if I'm flying along and my autopilot, my little Cessna starts deciding to push the nose to the ground, which it does sometimes, frankly, I expect that if I pull back on the column, it's going to stop. And it does. Now, these pilots were in a situation where nose started pointing at the ground, not that uncommon. They pulled back on the column and it didn't stop. And they had no frame of reference to give them why that would happen. And so you were instantly surrounded in a cloud of confusion, and your decision, your objective decision-making ability goes to zero right away. So the fact that, first of all, the system behaved in a way that was contrary to the way that pilots expect systems to behave for decades, that was a big problem. The bigger problem was that nobody told them to expect it. So they had no idea, right? Every time I pulled back on the column before, it's stopped, and it's not stopping now. I've never trained for a situation where that doesn't happen. So now I'm completely outside of what to expect. So that was huge.
You think they were scared?
Having been in a situation like that, you don't have time to be scared. You're kind of going, what the hell is going on? And you're trying to figure it out. But there's no scared mezzanine floor, if you will. You go from being confused to panicking, and you skip that intermediate step, if that makes sense.
Did Boeing betray these pilots?
Oh, absolutely.
In
multiple ways. It betrayed them by not telling them. It betrayed them by putting a system in the cockpit that left them with legal responsibility but took away their authority. And then it betrayed them after they were dead by blaming them in a really most revolting way, including, and excuse me for saying this, including with very overt racist overtones to it, that were completely unsupportable.
I need you to say Boeing betrayed these pilots, just that sentence.
Okay. Boeing betrayed the pilots.
That was wonderful. Let me keep going here. You've written that, you know, the actual engineering of MCAS is a bit opaque because Boeing has not let these engineers be identified or speak. Nevertheless, you and others have drawn conclusions about the culture inside Boeing that must have been in place to allow this to happen. Can you speak to that a little bit? What does this tell you? What are the engineering mistakes tell you about the company at this point in time?
That's obviously a huge topic. Long before the accidents happened, those of us who are interested in the industry and who watch the industry were aware of a cultural shift that was ongoing at Boeing. And frankly, it had been going on for decades. It's also not unique to Boeing. And it's not unique to the aerospace industry, but I'll give some aerospace examples. Very similar kinds of cultural shifts. And these are shifts away from what is kind of a startup engineering culture, an engineering-dominated culture, to a much more finance and marketing culture. And again, Boeing was not the first one. The best example that I can think of was the aircraft manufacturer Curtiss Wright that emerged from World War II. Is probably the largest aircraft aerospace venture in the world that was quickly taken over by Wall Street financiers, who essentially liquidated the company over the course of 30 years. It then happened again to McDonnell Douglas. People know that story well. And it was happening at Boeing. There's a great, I have a few histories of Boeing back in my library, and I remember reading back in the 90s, one of Boeing's earlier presidents who had come up from the engineering ranks had just become president, and he was about to go out on a sales call with his sales people to one of the airlines. They were trying to pitch a new airplane to them. And the salespeople had said, okay, you know, we're going to go in there and negotiate. And here's what we've figured out. We cannot go below $6 million an airplane. Right? That's our, we need to sell the airplanes for at least $6 million. So don't go below that figure. And they trotted off and they went to the airline. And this is an engineer who's become president of Boeing. And he sat down and with the representatives of the airline, and he said, well, my sales guy's telling me I can't go below $6 million. At which point, all the sales guys went, oh, my God. Right? But this is a person who's, you know, kind of an engineering mindset. You know, this is what it is. So, you know, let's just do this and move on, as opposed to kind of a sales-oriented negotiation mindset, if you will. And I thought it was a really kind of a warm characterization of the company at that time, is the company was coming out with world-beating great products where, you know, they had serially bet the company on the 707, for instance, a very really high risk-taking entrepreneurial environment and kind of a no bullshit environment, if you will. And by the mid-90s, even before Boeing's acquisition of McDonnell Douglas, they had become a quite different company. And so that's kind of the big picture of the cultural change that was going on. And again, it was that cultural change. A lot of people like to say, oh, it was because they bought McDonnell Douglas. No, it may have accelerated it, but that's where they were going anyways. And it was that cultural change and that kind of transition to a financial mindset that is part of that tragic story of MCAS.
Apply it to this situation where mistakes are happening in the engineering. And I think we get a clue about this from the emails, from the test pilots and others. Those emails have a tone in them, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
And a kind of lead you to believe something about the company and the environment in the company. Do you have any thoughts on that? What was going on inside Boeing?
Well, you know, a lot of people have made a lot of the emails themselves. For me, as a person who's been in, you know, I've been in a number of different companies. We were all making products. We were trying to sell them. The emails are not actually that egregious. They're the kind of inside baseball that goes on all the time. But they do reflect, to me, the biggest thing that they reflect is a lack of shared mission and a lack of support between the people who are, you know, putting the nuts and bolts together and the people who are supervising them. So what I heard in those emails was there are these problems that we're trying to deal with, and they're kind of typical problems, but I'm not going to get any sympathy from my boss. Whereas in the older culture where the boss was also had come out of that same milieu, the boss would have said, yeah, I understand why that's a problem. Right now, what I heard was when they went to the bosses were saying, I don't care.
And there's pressure, right? There's pressure, there's time and schedule pressure.
Yeah.
There's financial issues, right? Do you think that that may have played a role in these mistakes and the lack of catching the mistakes? Not necessarily the making of the mistakes, but the lack of catching the mistakes.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you see that. Absolutely. You see that throughout. There is this, it seems that the overarching criteria is essentially meeting schedules. And you are going to be punished in one way or another if you do not meet that schedule. And that's, I think that's it kind of in a nutshell. I think you can imagine that it's devastating, right? Safety doesn't meet a schedule. It's kind of, you know, to put a maybe not too fine of a point on it, it's serious. It's similar to what we're going on now with the pandemic. We keep on setting schedules. We're going to open up by such and such a date. Well, nature doesn't really care. It's going to do what it's going to do, and the same thing is true of safety.
We are having a few glitches in the video, but okay. I'm going to keep going, just because we have your clean audio, and I think we can patch it together. What do you make of the fact, well, first of all, would you characterize, did Boeing conceal MCAS?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Make sure you give us a full sentence because no one's going to hear my questions.
Okay. Did Boeing conceal MCAS? I don't think that there's any doubt about that. I think that they've admitted to that themselves. They did not put any mention of it in the pilot's operating handbook, which is the thing that would have told the pilots about its existence in the first place. They have said things about why they didn't put it in there. They have full-on admitted, yes, we concealed MCAS. Here are the reasons why we did it, but there's no argument on any side of the thing that they did do it.
Why do you think they did it?
I think that they did it because they were desperately trying to avoid getting the attention, first of all, of the FAA. The less the FAA knows about it, the less the FAA, the more that the FAA is going to accept Boeing's own self-certification. So a lot of the regulatory process is predicated on essentially prior art. So the more that I can say as a manufacturer, this is just like something in the past, or this is not that big of a change, the more that the regulators are going to say, sounds good. Now, if I come out and I say, well, this is a huge change, and it does this, 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 and this. And one of those huge changes is that no longer do the column cutout switches operate. Then you're going to subject yourself to much greater scrutiny. So a huge part of why they hit it was specifically to avoid scrutiny. And that goes to the schedule problem, because scrutiny slips your schedule. Right, so the less people are poking around, the more chance we have of meeting our schedule. It's simple as that.
Was there another reason in the simulator training? They seem to be obsessed by avoiding simulator training for the pilots.
Yeah, they had made promises to their customers. Those promises came with significant financial penalties if they were not met, that this 737 is exactly like every other 737. And a pilot can walk out of a 737 NG, walk into this thing, and with a 30 minutes worth of iPad presentation, fly it just as if they had flown the other one. You do not, what? Well, obviously not. We've got two crashes at this point that say it's not true. What?
to say it wasn't true.
No, it wasn't true. You know, and the evidence is the two crashes.
Okay. Give me a moment. You said something that really struck me in your article, and I'd love you to repeat it and explain it. You said that MCAS gaslights pilots. I love that phrase. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, MCAS gaslights pilots. What did I mean by that? What I meant by it is essentially, you know, the act of gaslighting is an attempt to make the other person feel mentally unwell by introducing clouds of confusion. Usually you do that by lying. But the goal is to separate themselves from themselves through confusion. The primary way in which it gaslit them here again was, to me as a pilot, when they pulled back on the column, it didn't stop. That fills a pilot's head with confusion. It's a classic definition of gaslighting to me.
Essentially, Boeing took flying out of the hands of their pilots with this system.
Yes.
Is that fair?
Yes, absolutely. And I don't think that taking flying out of the hands of the pilots is necessarily a bad thing. Airbus does that with its fly-by-wire.
Greg, pause a second, Greg.
Yep.
Greg, pause a second because I want to get this clean. And you
okay.
The video is seizing up. Let's try it. It looks good now. Let's try it one more time. Sorry about that.
Okay. Did Boeing take control away from the pilots? Absolutely. That's not to say that taking control away from the pilots is always a bad thing. In fact, it's often a good thing. Airbus does it with its fly-by-wire system. My Cessna does it with its autopilot. Pilots often would like to have control taken away from them so they can concentrate on maybe bigger issues like checking the weather. What was wrong about what Boeing did was it took control away from them without their consent. And not only without their consent, but without even their knowledge. And that's the big difference. That's the qualitative and ethical difference.
And at the same time, Boeing had the temerity to say, pilots are the backup here. That's why we only have one sensor, because pilots are the redundant system. They can manage any kind of problem that comes up.
Yes, and I'm laughing, but I'm laughing nervously, because it's so upsetting that's the line that they decided to take.
What line?
That the line that, well, pilots are the backup, right? And they pushed that line for a long time with what I will characterize, quite frankly, as a lie. And that lie is that an MCAS malfunction is the equivalent of what we call runaway trim. And so any pilot who knows how to deal with runaway trim should be able to deal with an MCAS malfunction because, and this is Boeing's words, they're the exact same thing. That's a lie. And the fact that they used that lie together with the uncomfortably racist, frankly, overtones about pilot training in non-US airlines makes it completely toxic. And it's toxic in a way that is just obscenely unfair. And I think, when I think about this, I think about those pilots. And I think about what they were going through. And when I hear Boeing say those kinds of things about those pilots who were heroes, I want to throw up and never stop throwing up.
Great answer, Greg. Great answer. Was I going to ask you? Well, why was it a lie?
Sorry, I got a little emotional about that.
I love that.
Yeah, so.
love you know, that. I mean, you're right. We've been interviewing Mr. Getachew, the pilot's father in Ethiopia. And he's had to live through not only the death of his son, but the smearing of his son.
Yeah.
This kid was an amazing pilot. He was the youngest pilot in Africa. He was incredibly hot commodity, this guy. And then for Boeing to say, and Boeing surrogates, by the way. Boeing apologists. I mean, I've heard a number of U.S. pilots say a U.S. pilot would have had no problem in that situation. Respond to that, if you would, even at the risk of repeating yourself.
Hold on a second. Nicola just raised a technical issue. She's still explaining it to me. The recording paused, and she has low disk space.
The recording just paused, I hope?
No, it paused like a minute ago. She needs to clear space. We need to take a minute. I know.
Well, which record? We have his audio, but
we have the audio.
What paused then?
I think we missed that emotional moment. Are you
kidding me?
I know.
Sorry, it's always like this, Greg. A key moment. But you had a wonderful way of saying that. I'm just going to, let's see. The lie piece. You said that Boeing lied, and can you just say that again and explain it to us?
Yeah. You asked me if Boeing had lied. And the answer absolutely is yes. Lying is not uncommon. Sometimes it can be useful and sometimes it can be excusable. I don't think that it passed either one of those bars in this case. And the lying really started with hiding the existence of MCAS from the pilots and everyone else in the first place. That's a sin of omission. Bad, really bad, but it wasn't as bad as the lies that took place after the crashes. And they were self-serving lies on Boeing's part, which is terrible, to try and protect itself when it didn't need to protect itself, frankly, but it chose to do so anyways. But what really began to cross the line was when they lied not only about the circumstances, but about the pilots themselves. And this is where I get emotional. As a pilot, as somebody who's responsible, as somebody who is doing his or her best, I can feel in my heart and in my head what their experience must have been like. They are in an aircraft that is hurtling out of control, that is not responding to them in the manner that they expected to respond from their years and years of experience and training. And it's not doing that, not because of anything they've done wrong, but because they've been lied to about what that airplane is in the first place. So now they're trying to deal with a situation that is overwhelming, in which they are contemplating, no doubt, their own imminent demise, and they're unsuccessful in their efforts. Now, after that, the company comes back and it says, well, it's not our fault. It's the pilot's fault, because this is just like a runaway trim condition, and every pilot knows how to deal with a runaway trim condition. They're lying again. It's not like a runaway trim condition. Not at all. So they've committed a lie on top of these dead people's bodies, blaming them for something that no pilot, no U.S. pilot, no European pilot, no any pilot could have dealt with. And that is something that Captain Sullenberger attested to. He said, I tried it. I couldn't do it. You know?
It's a smear.
It's a smear. Why do you feel it necessary to smear people who did the best they could, given the circumstances that you put them into? That you put them into. And now you're going to smear them to save yourself? It's unbelievable.
That was even better. Thank you very much. I couldn't agree with you more. We're getting to the end here. I'm just to ask you, and this is just totally speculative, Greg. I have no idea. You've been through something yourself personally that gives you a little bit more authority to talk about what a pilot feels in a dangerous situation than most.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to talk about that a little bit or not? You were in a hijack.
I was hijacked. It's the most ridiculous thing in the world, but 30 years ago, a mentally disturbed individual happened to approach me as I was putting my airplane away one night, getting ready for home. He had had a beef at work and had set out to try and kill his boss, I'm told, and hadn't found his boss, and then decided he needed to get out of town and he was going to hijack an airplane to do it. And I was on the wrong end of that stick. I don't think the details are important, but I think for what we've been talking about here, the fundamental thing, I learned two things from that experience. I learned, first of all, that decision-making in that kind of a situation becomes easier, not harder. The more constraints that are placed on you, the less options you have. And so it becomes an exercise of how do I start to increase my options? And that's, you know, really trying to get yourself back into control. It's actually fairly, I remember it was a long time ago, but it's fairly calming. Okay, I know here's the range of my actions. I just got to pick one of these things and do that and try and keep this thing going. So there was that. The other thing from a pilot's perspective and from a decision-making perspective that it taught me was that when you are under that kind of stress, your cognitive ability goes to zero. It was, I found it very difficult to do just basic things. We were flying, it was at night, there was a little bit of weather, and we were getting set up to make a landing. Something called an instrument landing system. It's very routine. It's how you do an approach. And even figuring out kind of the next steps in that, which are burned into me, became hard. I don't remember feeling confused. I was just like, okay, now I should do this, but I'm not really sure why. I guess it was just a thing about just how little kind of troubleshooting ability you have. You become very mechanistic in a sense.
I wonder if that explains why the Ethiopian pilots flip back on MCAS at the very end. You don't have the perspective that you do in hindsight, right?
Yeah, you don't have any ability. You know, that's a great point. A lot has been made about in the Lion Air crash. There had been a crew that had flown the same airplane with the same problems before, and they had, you know, they had not crashed, obviously. And a lot of people say, well, look, these guys were able to do it, so these guys should do it. There's a very important difference that's often glossed over. In that instance, there was a third pilot in the cockpit riding in the jump seat. So you've got a typical 737 cockpit normally has a pilot and a co-pilot. Those are the only two people in there. There's a jump seat which sits behind them. In this case, there was a third pilot there. And that third pilot appears to have been the critical difference because he was able to sit back while these other two were struggling with the controls, not knowing what's going on. He was able to see the big picture, if you will. And that's the critical difference. And so, you know, people have said, well, you know, why... You know, they should have been able to do it based on this other thing. And my answer to that is, well, then let's require a three-person crew in every 737. Because that's what it's going to take if you don't fix the system.
Let's move on to the final few questions, mm-hmm. Big questions. If you had a chance to meet and talk to some of the family members from ET-302 in particular, And after obviously expressing your condolences, what do you think you might say to them?
I have had a chance to meet a few of them. And I'll be quite honest, it is difficult for me to know even what to say to them. My wife passed away suddenly, and I remember the pain in people's faces as they came up to me. They wanted to be able to say something. They wanted to provide some comfort, but they didn't know what to say. They weren't able to put themselves in my shoes. And I understand that completely. There's no way for me to understand, you know, I can understand what it means to have a loss of that magnitude, but I don't know what it is that I can say to them to make it better, although I would desperately want to. But I can say that what we are going to do as hard as we can is to make sure that responsibility falls where it should, if that makes sense.
That's all they want. Would you say to them, would you say that their anger is justified?
I'm pausing only because that's actually an almost overwhelming question. The short answer is, of course, absolutely yes. It's at least in my experience, it's a bigger question than that. I imagine, I don't know, again, I imagine that it's, you know, describing them as being angry doesn't do justice to what their emotions must honestly be. I would say their grief as absolutely justified. I don't want to really cheapen it, at least for myself, by deconstructing it just to anger. Anger is not complex.
Well, the reason I ask that is because, of course, they are and have been dealing with grief every day, and we shot with them in Addis Ababa on the 1 year anniversary, and we saw that up close. But there are a number of them, I would even say maybe most of them, that want to channel that anger into something concrete. And it's been very moving to us to hear them talk about their desire to reform what they regard as a broken system.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's what I'm asking about justification. Are they right that the system is broken? Are they right to be focused on that? Or is that just a kind of quixotic, impossible goal? I mean, is Boeing fixable? Is our air safety system fixable? Or even need fixing?
Absolutely, they are right in wanting to see it fixed, wanting to see reforms. They are right in their anger and their grief that it happened in the first place, because again, this was not an accident, this was a tragedy. So to the degree to which they want to fix that tragedy, you know, there's a concept of the angel of history that is constantly being trying to clean up what happened in the past, but is being pushed into the future by progress. And we don't want that angel of history to be pushed into the future without addressing the mess of the past. And we have to do that. What does that mean? It's a huge, huge, huge issue. What happened, it happened for so many different reasons. It happened because of regulatory deconstruction to the manufacturer. We, as a society, made a decision to let the fox guard the hen house. And nobody said, well, hey, that might end badly. Why didn't they say that? Why did nobody see this? Well, the obvious answers are things like greed. How do we fix greed, right? I don't know the answer to that, but it doesn't mean that we shouldn't try on their behalf.
Wonderful. Greg, repeat one more time what you said. This was not an accident, this was a tragedy, and explain what you mean. I think we'll leave it at that.
This was not an accident, this was a tragedy. What do I mean by that?
Do it, get into it a little bit. Sorry. It's a fantastic line that we're going to use. Do it with some...
I don't even remember what I said, but okay.
Give it some purpose. Okay. Unpack that. I mean, that's a remarkable insight, I think. This is not an accident. This was not an accident. This was a tragedy. And then explain what you mean.
This was not an accident. It was a tragedy. And by a tragedy, I mean that this is a story. It is an epic story. It is an epic story made up of more than just cause and effect relationships. Of course, cause and effect play, but there were circumstances. There was a reality that was set in motion. And once it was set in motion, and it was set in motion years, decades ago. And when it was set in motion those decades ago, what happened last year became inevitable. And that is the definition of tragedy. We got to that point not because of chance, not because of an accident, but because there was nothing else that could have happened.
Fantastic. Wonderful. Wow. All right. Anything I'm forgetting, Charlotte?
No, that was fantastic.
Yeah. I'm sorry about all the little technical...
No problem.
I think these Zoom things are overwhelmed at the moment.
as we all are.
Yeah, that was really amazing. And just makes me... can't wait for the actual interview with the camera. And we won't have any of these issues. We can talk more in depth. But that was stupendous. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And please stay safe. And we'll be in touch about the real thing coming up.
Okay. Any idea on the timeline? I'm just trying to make my summer plans.
No, so, I can't answer that with any kind of real confidence. We're thinking about resuming.